hardball hitting with a baseball bat. Kick up your heels, kid, and leave them all flat. What does it mean to be American?
This is Democracy Optimist. Here's your host, Professor Joshua Douglas of the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law.
Welcome to Democracy Optimist, where we bring you the good, the bad, and the ugly on voting rights and election law with a dose of hope sprinkled in. This year's presidential election is once again unprecedented, especially when it comes to the nominees. The Republican Party has nominated former President Donald Trump, who was convicted of multiple felonies. The Democrats were about to nominate President Joe Biden, but just weeks before the Democratic National Convention, he announced, under immense pressure, that he was dropping out. Now Vice President Kamala Harris will be the Democratic nominee. How could the Democrats switch nominees? Well, Biden was never actually the official nominee of the party, so no legal change has occurred. When you vote in the primary, you're actually voting for delegates to the political party's convention, who will then vote to nominate a particular candidate. It's sort of like the Electoral College. In November, you will be voting for electors, not the presidential candidates directly. For the primaries, with a candidate dropping out before the convention, the delegates are free to choose whoever they think will be the best nominee. That fact demonstrates that the nomination process is itself pretty complex. Here to discuss those details is Elaine Kmark. She serves as a senior fellow in governance studies and is the director of the Center for Effective Public Management at the Brookings Institution. She's also an expert on American electoral politics and the presidential nomination system. And she's the author of Primary Politics, Everything You Need to Know About How America Nominates Its Presidential Candidates, and Why Presidents Fail and How They Can Succeed Again. Before we start, here's a quick programming note, which includes a bit of radio magic. The interview you are about to hear was recorded before Biden dropped out. You might notice that we discuss Biden as if he will be the nominee. But you'll also hear Elaine talk about what could happen if a party needs to choose someone else at the convention, which is exactly what occurred this year. With all that said, let's jump in. Elaine, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with the foundation. You're an expert in the primary and nomination process. Walk us through the different kinds of primary and caucus systems for presidential nominations. What are the various different types and why do states vary so much in how they do it?
Well, basically, the two major parties these days mostly use presidential primaries. Over the last couple of years, there's been a move away from caucuses. Caucuses are kind of an old-fashioned way of selecting delegates to the convention, and most states have replaced their caucuses with primaries. Caucuses are still there, though, and what people don't like about them is that you have to actually show up and participate. And that's a problem. That's a problem for a lot of people. If you're in the military and you're deployed overseas, it's hard to, you know, you can't participate in a caucus. If you're a mother with little kids at home, it might be hard to find a babysitter, et cetera. So the trend has been mostly to presidential primaries. Now, what people forget, right, is that the primaries do not themselves nominate the president. The primaries elect delegates to conventions, and conventions still elect the nominees for each party. And that's been going on since 1831. And the big difference is that up until 1972, most of the delegates were chosen in some kind of party system, and the presidential candidates weren't on ballots. There were few primaries in those days, and not many of them actually elected delegates. After a set of reform rules that the Democrats started, both parties started to elect delegates as a result of primaries. And that was the big shift in our nomination process.
And at the convention themselves, it used to be that at least many of the delegates were essentially free agents and didn't have to vote for the candidate who won their state. And that's changed as well, right?
Yeah. I mean, these days, the delegates in both parties are expected to vote for the person they were elected to represent. Now, there's a slight difference in the parties. The Republican Party pretty much says you have to vote the way you were elected to vote. The Democratic Party says you should vote the way you were elected to vote in all good conscience. So it says if, you know, something happens, you may vote for somebody else. And remember that these rules are adopted at the opening of each party's convention. So the party itself can then change, you know, suppose the candidate had a heart attack and died or something like that. I mean, the party convention, the party itself could change the rules.
Mm-hmm. So there seems to be a lot of negative sentiment about the two major party candidates this year. What factors do you think contributed to having the same two people nominated this year as in 2020?
Even though there's a lot of negative sentiment, they had strong enough bases in their respective parties that they didn't really have a serious challenge. Okay, so nobody challenged President Biden except for an obscure congressman from Minnesota that nobody had ever heard of, and nobody could figure out why he should be president, and a Marianne Williamson, who's a spiritual advisor, who didn't do well very last time around and did even worse this time around. So it's hard to beat someone with no one. No one in the Democratic Party wanted to challenge Joe Biden, and the reason is he's very popular among a large swath of Democrats. Ditto for the Republicans. Now, Trump had more serious challengers than Biden did, which makes sense. He was defeated as president. There were some people in the Republican Party thought he shouldn't run again, that he might lose again, even worse this time. So some people in the Republican Party decided to challenge him, and they didn't get very far. Okay, Nikki Haley did the best, and she got between 5% and 40% of the vote, depending on the primary you're looking at. There were people who continued to vote in the Republican primaries for Nikki Haley, even though she was no longer campaigning and she dropped out of the race. So it showed that there was some opposition to Trump, but not nearly enough to deny him the nomination. So you have to look at this dilemma against the fact that each candidate had a very strong base in their party.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk, kind of going back to the beginning of the primary and nomination system, about Iowa and New Hampshire, which are seen as the traditional first states to have a caucus in Iowa and New Hampshire with the primary. I know the Democrats have pushed back against the system, trying to give South Carolina a greater say, especially given the large minority population there that helped to rescue Biden's campaign in 2020. What do you think about Iowa and New Hampshire having the first voting opportunities in the presidential nomination system? I think we're starting to see some changes there. Do you expect that to continue?
Well, the Democrats did see changes there. They didn't start to. They did say changes. The Iowa caucuses were not first in the Democratic Party. The New Hampshire primary was held, but it was not a binding primary. And they had to hold a second system in May in order to get their delegates seated at the convention. Now, it wasn't terribly controversial this time because, as I said, only Biden was running. You know, there wasn't a serious challenge to Biden. Next time around, I expect that South Carolina will be first on the Democratic side. I don't know what will happen on the Republican side. Okay. In both parties over the years, there's been some resentment about these two states having the, you know, those prime slots, if you will. And so I don't know what will happen on the Republican side, but I think on the Democratic side, you're going to see South Carolina first.
Now, you know, in support of these states going first, you know, hear a lot about, well, the voters in these places take the job of vetting the candidates very seriously. There's a lot of retail politics. You can go to the diners and actually meet these people. You know, will we lose some of that, you know, whether it's charm or getting to, you know, kind of know the candidates personally? Do you think we start to lose some of that with other states going first, you know, especially larger states?
Well, there's not been a lot of consideration to having larger states go first for exactly the reason you just said. The thought is certainly among the Democrats, and I think among the Republicans too, that there is some advantage to having the process start in a small state. That being said, South Carolina is a small state. Nevada is a small state. New Hampshire is a small state, and they're all still early in the system. So it's not so that value of what the small states bring to the nomination system, it's still important. It still exists. Just there's other small states.
Sure. Yeah. Just different small states, obviously, with very different demographics. If you're comparing, say, New Hampshire and South Carolina, which obviously, and Nevada, as you mentioned, which obviously on the Democrat side, they want to value those demographic differences. The kind of the next big moment in the nomination process, I think, is Super Tuesday, right, where you have a number of states, maybe over a dozen, 16 or so states who have their primaries all at the same time. Tell us a little bit about whether that makes sense. Should we have, you know, midway through or, you know, kind of beginning to middle where we have this day that's so important in the nomination process?
Super Tuesday, remember, happened organically. It happened when both parties decided that it was crazy to have a nomination system that was going into Christmas the year before the election year. And both parties realized in the 2010s that they had to have a start date for the nomination system and make some exceptions for these small states to go first. And the start date ended up being, and again, both parties talked about this, being the first Tuesday in March. So a lot of states think, okay, we want to have a role here, we want to have a campaign in our state, et cetera, and they've moved to the first Tuesday in March. And they hope that they can get a piece of the action by moving there. There is, as I say, this is sort of organic because the decision on when to hold your primary is a little bit a decision of the national parties, which say you start this date and we're going to give a couple exceptions for these small early states. But after that, it's an interaction between the state parties and the state legislature, especially if it's a state run primary and the state is going to pay for it. They have a lot to say on it. So some states rush to the beginning to try to be important. Some states like to have one primary and just have their congressional and state and all the primaries on the same day, and they like to keep that where it has been traditionally. Some states split their presidential and their congressional primaries. It's a mixed bag, and there isn't really any one person or group that decides.
So the parties used to choose their presidential nominees essentially through backroom deals, and it was the party leaders that had the biggest say. And we've moved now to the voters, you know, having the say of, as we mentioned, in, you know, on the Republican side, you're supposed to vote for who won your state, the Democrats, or maybe I had that opposite of which one you're strongly encouraged to. The Democrats used to have so-called superdelegates that could also kind of sway the nomination potentially. So is it better now that we have a system where the voters in the parties are choosing? Or are there some benefits to the party leadership having a greater say in the nomination process?
You know, there are good and bad to each one, okay? Obviously, the old-fashioned way wasn't always very representative. A lot of those smoke-filled rooms were all men and all white. So it really was, you know, somewhat unfair that a smaller number of people got to make the choice. On the other hand, what we have lost is what we call peer review. In other words, candidates are not looked at by other political leaders who are also government leaders and know something about government. So it's a very, you know, that this notion of peer review is something that we take for granted in other professions, right? Your neurosurgeon has to be approved and reviewed by other neurosurgeons. Okay, you don't select a neurosurgeon on the basis of, you know, he's got a good smile or makes you laugh or something like that, right? You select somebody who's been validated. In the old days, the candidates that were looked at were pretty much candidates who had some experience in politics and in government. And the party leaders evaluated them on those two dimensions. Could they win? Could they run and win? And could they govern? And that was where the element of peer review, you know, came in. These days, it's sort of missing. And you see that in the lots of people who've tried to get on the debate stage in the two political parties who really had no business being president, okay, and wouldn't really know very much about doing the job. So it's a mixed bag, but we ought to think about the value of having people who know government doing some evaluation, having some role in the person who is going to lead the biggest government.
Yeah, that's interesting in terms of the trade-offs that you have with the elimination of the party leaders having a role here. So on this show, I've talked previously about ranked choice voting, the system where voters rank order the candidates instead of having to choose just one. And several states have moved or are thinking about moving to ranked choice voting for their primary. And I'm curious if you could give us your reflections on the states that are using ranked choice voting for the primary process.
It seems to be working pretty well. Maine has done it. Alaska has done it. Now, those are not very representative states, but it seems to be working pretty well, especially in a primary where the differences between the candidates on issues don't tend to be very stark. It's a good way to get a sense of, you know, who people like in the party. So I actually think it's a pretty good way to do it. It doesn't particularly work in the general election because you've got two candidates, you know what I mean? You've just got two parties. So you can't see it working there. It works in a multi-party or a multi-candidate field.
Well, unless you have a strong third party candidate, right? You talk about the spoiler effect and whatnot.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, and it's interesting, and you know, I think it's Nevada. It has a ballot measure this year to adopt ranked choice voting. It was already approved by the voters once, but to be in the Nevada Constitution, it has to be approved a second time. And so we'll see if other states join Maine and Alaska in using that kind of a system. So this show is called Democracy Optimist, and I'm curious, given your studies of the presidential nomination system and everything you've seen and the results of, you know, the candidates who come out of the nomination process over the past several cycles, are you an optimist about democracy?
Yeah, I tend to be an optimist about democracy. I think the nomination system has got its flaws, but it's basically moved towards being more open, more inclusive. It's very transparent. Okay, I mean, primaries are extremely transparent. And as I said at the beginning, the nomination system is moving away from caucuses and towards almost all primaries. I think this year there were more than 40 primaries in states. So, you know, it's really gone in that direction. I think that it could be improved. I think we could invent things that would inject some element of peer review into the process, and that would be helpful. But I'm pretty optimistic that we have a pretty good system. And one of the things that helps it be very democratic is that it goes on for a long time. Now, some people complain about that, but there's a lot of learning that takes place from, you know, the end of January, when you generally have the first primary or caucus, all the way through the convention. We find out a lot about the people who are running. We find out that whether we like them or not, we find out what kind of character they have, et cetera. And then you still have the convention, which is kind of in the modern system, kind of a fail safe. You know, the convention is where if something went wrong in the primaries, something happened to the candidate, et cetera, you still have the convention. So I think there's a lot of opportunity for voters to have their input here. And there's an opportunity for safeguards.
So we're in an election year. So my question for you is, why should people vote?
Well, because you're part of a country and the decisions people are going to make are going to affect you, pure and simple. I mean, you know, and if you have some knowledge and some predilection, I mean, let's face it, that we've got a very, very personal issue up this year is abortion. Is the future of abortion rights in America. And a lot of people, that's a personal issue. A lot of women between the ages of, say, 15 and 45, that's a big issue for them. And for other women, it's an issue for their daughters and their granddaughters. So, you know, people should vote because your vote matters. It matters in things that vote to you. There may be things that you don't understand, you don't know about. And in a representative democracy, sometimes we just say to the person we elect, look, you go figure out what the Telecommunications Act is about and how it should be fixed, right? And on other things, we say to them, look, I am pro-choice and I expect my senator or congressman to vote pro-choice. So Americans don't know, have opinions about everything, but we have to participate if we want our opinions about things we do know about to matter.
Elaine Kmark is an expert on the presidential nomination system and is a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution. Elaine, thank you so much for joining Democracy Optimist.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on here.
Josh, what happens to voters who are not registered with a political party? Can they vote in a primary?
Well, it depends. Registered independents are the fastest growing group of voters in many states. But depending on the primary system used, many of them are not allowed to vote in the primary at all. In states with a closed primary, like our state of Kentucky, only voters registered with a political party can vote in that party's primary. Open primaries and states with a top two system, where the top two vote recipients move on to the general election, by contrast, allow any voter to participate. But voters can't go back and forth between parties on the same day. The Supreme Court outlawed what is known as a blanket primary, where a voter could select the Republican nominee for governor, Democratic nominee for Congress, and so on. The court ruled that this system violates a political party's First Amendment right to associate. Therefore, in open primary states, voters have to choose just the Democratic Party or Republican Party nominees for all offices that year. Of course, there have been various lawsuits about these rules. In a case from 1986, the Supreme Court ruled that if a political party wants to allow independents to vote in their primaries, the state cannot stop them. Thus, even in a state with a closed primary system, the parties themselves could choose to welcome independents, though, of course, many party leaders would not want to do this, as it could harm their hold on party leadership. There have also been lawsuits regarding fusion candidacies, or a system where two parties nominate the same person. Sometimes a small third party will want to show its support for a candidate who is also the nominee of the Republican or Democratic Party in an effort to gain support for the minor political party. But the Supreme Court has held that states are allowed to ban fusion candidacies if they want, and currently only five states allow fusion candidates.
How long have we used primaries and caucuses to select presidential nominees?
It's actually somewhat a modern practice. After the founding, a convention of state guild delegates in each state would simply decide who should receive the state's electoral college votes. But once the party system really took off in the early 1800s, parties began having caucuses of party leaders to choose nominees. According to the National Constitution Center, the first organized party convention was for the Anti-Masonic Party in 1831. The National Republicans, a party opposed to President Andrew Jackson, had a national meeting in December 1831, where they selected Kentucky's own Henry Clay as the party's presidential nominee. Party bosses continued to select presidential nominees for decades. Some parties had primaries, but those primaries had little effect on how political bosses selected the nominees. The 1950s saw primaries begin to gain steam, and John F. Kennedy used them to help propel his candidacy in 1960, particularly after his strong performance in the West Virginia primary that year. Then, after Minnesota Senator Eugene McCarthy won the most primary votes in 1968, but lost the nomination at the Democratic National Convention to fellow Minnesotan Senator Hubert Humphrey based on the preferences of the party leaders, there was a stronger push to give voters more say through a primary process. In 1976, Democrats used primaries to select 73% of the delegates at their convention, while Republicans used primaries to select 68% of their delegates. The 1984 election saw the creation of Super Tuesday, the date when a large number of states have primaries to choose the delegates to the political party conventions. Then, in 1988, Southern states joined together to have their Super Tuesday on the same day in an effort to give the South more power in the nomination process. Now the parties use primaries to select their nominees, but the Democrats recently still gave party bosses some say. Many people might remember the so-called superdelegates that were allowed to vote in the 2016 nomination battle between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. Democrats eliminated superdelegates for the 2020 presidential nomination system.
What's that one thing that we can do to support democracy?
Well, maybe you want to try to predict the outcome of the presidential election this year, or you might want to see how a swing state going to one candidate or the other will impact who wins. Supporting democracy means being a better educated voter. Well, you can do all of that at 270towin.com, which offers an interactive map that lets you see what happens if states go one way or the other. For example, you could change the map. Just click on a state to make it red or blue to come up with a plausible but perhaps nightmare scenario where there's a 269-269 tie in the Electoral College. Then the decision would be thrown to the House of Representatives, which would vote by state delegation, one vote per state, on the winner. It's a good idea for all of us to be informed about these possibilities before November.
Thanks for joining us for this series of conversations about how elections work, about the value of your vote, and about challenges to your right and freedom to make choices at your local polling place. Find our series online at democracyoptimist.com. Joshua Douglas, writer and host, Mike Savage, executive producer. I'm Tom Martin, your series producer. Neil Kesterson, technical director and sound designer. Democracy Optimist theme song, American, by Madeline Peru. Mason Graber and Stephen Dabney, research assistants. Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Democracy Optimist is a special Eastern Standard series produced by Dynamics Productions for Richmond, Kentucky-based public radio station WEKU.